Well, in part by grants from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we spend the hour with some of the people responsible for bringing a new literary journal to life here at the University of Illinois. Ninth Letter seeks to dig up the posts and fences that can corral literary writing. The editor's goals: to create a conversation, a dialogue between the fields of fiction and nonfiction, the visual arts, science, history, and cultural studies. The journal is beautiful. It contains work from more than 24 contributors. Between the covers, you'll find fiction, poetry, photography, an interview, a couple of letters written by Mark Twain, never before published. Three guests are with me here in the studio this afternoon. They are the editor, Jody Rubens, the poetry editor, Michael Madonic, and the assistant editor, Christopher Meyer. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Copies of the journal, Ninth Letter, are available at the Illini Union Bookstore and Borders Books, Music, and Cafe. Copies of Ninth Letter will also be available at a party launching the journal this evening at 7 p.m. at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois. And three writers whose work appears in the first issue will perform readings. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, and congratulations on a beautiful journal.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, let's talk first about Ninth Letter, the title for this journal. What does the name signify, Jody?
Well, actually, I think I'll let one of the other two editors answer that question, because I actually didn't even come into this project until very late. I just moved here in September. The title and the manifesto had already been decided on. It's something that I'm very excited about, but I'd like Chris to talk about that.
Well, Ninth Letter actually came from the guy sitting beside me, and we had bounced around a bunch of ideas, and one day this light went off above his head, and he came into the room. I think it was a light, and he came into the room, and he said he had this idea, Ninth Letter, and so we bounced around a bunch of ideas and had a list of probably 50 names that a bunch of us sat in a room and debated. And eventually decided Ninth Letter was going to be the name.
Okay, so what does it signify? The ninth letter of the alphabet?
Often it helps to be somewhat dim-witted, and I think I have the corner on that, certainly, with the people here right now. And what happened was, looking at the university logo, which we went to great expense to come up with, it finally occurred to me that maybe we should be looking at the letter I and just simply counted out and came to the ninth letter and thought that this significance would move itself over to the magazine back and forth between the two areas. And it also seemed to us that we did not want to overtly identify the magazine as the university magazine, but did want to connect that relationship. So that's how it came about.
Yeah. Now, is there a founding mother, a founding father, a founding set of aunts and uncles for the Ninth Letter?
Again, I'm probably the least qualified person to answer that, being the last person to come on board. But my understanding was that Chris was really the first person to come in as a first-year graduate student and ask, why don't we have a magazine? Where's the magazine? Let's start a literary magazine. And he got a number of the graduate students very excited, and also the faculty members got very excited. And I think that the energy of the department as a whole, because it's a new department, the students are very close, and the faculty members are very close to them as well, just spearheaded this project. Everyone got excited about the opportunity to do something new, and then the people at Art and Design, the professors and students over there, got involved as well, and all of these energies came together and made this into a much bigger event than anybody anticipated when Chris first came in and said, can we start a magazine?
Mm-hmm. And what is this new department?
It's just the creative writing department. The MFA program, graduate program, wasn't here 2 years ago, so I'm part of the first class. And I think there were 15 of us who came in the first year. And so really it was a lot of people showing up in the program who were here because they wanted to initiate things. And so that's how it got started, as Jody said, a bunch of us getting together once every week or two, students and then some faculty members just bouncing around ideas. It seemed really too big to achieve for a while. And then last summer, about a year after we'd all been here, things just started falling into place.
Yeah, well, it's quite an accomplishment to come from you know, something brand new to seeing this beautiful journal right here on the table. Everybody's got a copy of it. It is such an undertaking. Where did you all begin? Chris?
All right. I'll answer this one.
This is why we brought you.
Yeah, right. Well, where we began really was like I said, it began initially with just trying to see what sort of energy we had, and realizing that when you're starting from scratch, you obviously have no resources, so energy was the biggest thing that we could try to gather. And as we did that, we started fanning out away from our program. So talking to people at the Fine and Applied Arts Department, speaking with folks in other administrative offices, trying to figure out how we could build connections to other departments and other corners of campus so that this would be something not only we'd be excited about and would sort of achieve our goals, but also something that the university would be excited about because of the interdisciplinary feel of it.
Yeah, it does really have that feel really comes across. And I'm wondering, you know, what's an editorial meeting like to have all this energy and all these people from across campus come together?
It's kind of chaos right now. We have a lot of meetings in which nothing or very little gets done. And we have so many people involved at this point that we have a number of – we're constantly having smaller group meetings just to focus on specific tasks. We are actually planning a big group meeting next week with all of the students and faculty members that are involved from Art and Design and all of the people from the writing program as well to sort of get our minds around what we've just done, which it's almost impossible to understand how this magazine came out of the chaos that was happening in the last few months. But we did it, and so now we have to step back and look at how we did it,
right,
and what we need to fine-tune for the next issue.
I think we could probably say that though it is chaotic, there's a wonderful chaos that underlies all of this. And I think that there was a tradition here that existed before the magazine, with a magazine that was affiliated with the university. Accent was here for many years, and a lot of the faculty members, when we were initiating the MFA program, which took about 10 years to finally get into its full application, had a notion of a magazine being there, though I can say that none of us on a individual or even collective basis could have pulled this off without the graduate students and our editor.
Yeah, and I have a question for you, editor. In your note, in your editor's note to this first issue, you write about your frustrations with the arbitrary boundaries placed around literary writing. What have those boundaries been? Talk with us about that.
There, in my experience in the last 10 years, which is how long I've been working in literary publishing, there have been restrictions, sort of arbitrary restrictions placed by editors on what consists, what makes up literature. And I use quotation marks when I say literature because whether it's restrictions on subject matter, on style, even so-called experimental fiction and poetry often has to fall into a preconceived set of guidelines that the editors have already sort of pre-approved, and anything that falls outside that is written off or disregarded as not really art or not really literature. And I've found that frustrating because I've seen a number of extremely bright and talented writers and artists get disregarded and, you know, eventually give up their work because they can't get any notice. They can't find a forum for what they're trying to do. So when I first met with this group of people and I talked to them about what they were interested in doing with their as yet unpublished magazine, I realized that they shared some of my frustration with those restrictions.
It sounds like chaos is something you folks have to hang on to.
I don't think there's any danger of us losing that, really.
After what you just said, Jody, I'm thinking about the afterword written by Joseph Squire. And he takes what you said at the beginning in the editor's note, and he also addresses some of these same issues, but in a different kind of way. And I don't know if it would be useful here to somebody read a portion of Squire's afterword. I thought it was very enlightening.
I can look at it, and I think I can talk about it a little bit, too.
It begins with an epigraph. In the beginning, there were no names it was necessary to point. You want to read a paragraph or two?
I'll read the opening.
Yeah.
It is curious how someone like myself, trained to communicate with images and not words, finds himself writing the afterword for a literary journal. Although I've always been in love with words, I consume them voraciously and delight in crafting them, I would never think to call myself a writer. But come to think of it, none of the other labels have ever felt very comfortable either. At various times I've been described as a photographer or a painter, and most recently as an electronic artist, whatever that means. I am struck by my own and the world's incessant urge to name, to pin things down. And I think Joseph and I have talked about this many times, about the idea of naming things and categorizing things being a kind of restriction, and labels imposing boundaries that ultimately inhibit art and literature.
Well, when I was thinking about this yesterday, as I was thinking about how to say what we were about here this afternoon, I had this picture of rolling up a barbed wire fence. That's what you folks are trying to do, you know, and letting things, you know, letting people communicate with one another and to have this dialogue across, you know, between photographers, painters, electronic artists, poets, people who write nonfiction and people who write fiction.
It's an interesting idea, but it's not as easy as it sounds because the need to label things and set boundaries and isolate things and call them fiction or call them poetry and not let them relate to one another is something that we do without thinking about it, and it's so hard to make yourself let go of that. And I don't know if we'll ever be entirely successful, but it's something that I think we're all at least striving for.
Mm. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us from out of state on the toll-free line, a listener in Pennsylvania. So if you want to put your headsets on, we'll talk with this caller on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
I heard some discussion at the beginning of the program about letters from Mark Twain. I wonder how they came about. I heard they were unpublished before.
Those letters came about from actually a friend of mine who I went to college with. And when I would go back to, he lived in Maine, and we'd go back to his house, his family would always talk about who got to sleep in the Mark Twain bedroom. And I'd always say, well, I get to sleep in the Mark Twain bedroom. I'm the writer here. And eventually, you know, the story came out as to where those letters came from or where the name for the room came from. It was because up in their attic there were these letters that they had just never really bothered to clean the dust off of and bring downstairs. So when I was there, probably a couple of years ago, right when we were starting to talk about this magazine, I said, can I have a look at those letters maybe? And brought them down. Then once the whole magazine started coming together, I said, I think we can bring these letters in and maybe get someone to talk about them.
Now, how did you authenticate them?
That's That's a good question. How did we authenticate them? Basically, what we did was we looked at the history, and they told us when they came about. They gave us the dates. We passed them on to someone here who's a Mark Twain scholar. He had a look at them, passed them on to Michael Martone, obviously, who wrote about these pieces for us. And the history just fell together, the time at which Mark Twain was, in fact, staying there in York, Maine, and the time that the letters were dated.
I think it has been documented that Twain was staying there at this house.
Yes.
So there's a whole documentation behind the letters.
Mm-hmm.
And the letters are very short, very brief. You want to give us some idea of what's in those letters? There's really...
What's in the letters really is nothing of amazing literary value.
No.
And that's what I think is really interesting about what Martone wrote about these pieces. It's just the way in which we come to value something as a literary artifact without it itself having any sort of implicit literary value. So it's just very interesting how we in our own minds tend to value these things that, say, Mark Twain wrote, when really what's he writing about? He's writing about the fact that his razor wasn't sharp enough and he wants a new one, you know?
Thank you very much. Please send me something that will do the job for me. Listener, is there anything else you wanted to say before we go?
No, that's great. Okay. How can I get the magazine?
Okay, Jody?
Probably the easiest way to get it from out of state would be to go to our website, which is www.ninthletter.com. You can order online. Single copies are $12.95, and a subscription is $19.95.
Okay, and is that Ninth Letter spelled out?
Spelled out, yes.
Okay. All right, great.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. So if you're listening on the Internet, you can give us a call, 800-222-WILL in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. WILL. Three guests are with me here this afternoon in the studio. They are the editor of Ninth Letter, Jody Rubens, the poetry editor, Michael Madonik, and assistant editor, Christopher Meyer. My name is Celeste Quinn. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. That's interesting how these letters sparked the essay from Michael Martone. Did other things come together in the same manner?
Well, we actually we solicited that. We sent the letters to Michael Martone and asked him to write something. We didn't tell him what to write in any way. We just said, here are these letters. Are you interested in, you know, using them as a jumping off point? What do they make you think about? And he was very interested in doing that. That's the only thing that I think that we did in that way, in that deliberate solicitation way. Everything else, all the other connections that had been made in this issue were completely serendipitous. We had the story from Robert Owen Butler that came in, which was based on an actual postcard, an antique postcard that he has in a collection. He had written a story for his forthcoming book and sent it to us to consider, and we already had these Twain letters. We had no idea what Michael Martone was going to write about the letters, and his piece on the letters actually came back quite late in our editorial schedule, and it turned out to be in part about postcards, which relates to the Butler story, which relates to letters, which was, you know, we had no plans for that at all.
Yeah. Well, I really like the surprises that one finds in going through and turning the pages. You know, we have the interview with Jan Martel, the author of Life of Pi, and preceding that interview is a poem, Toy Tiger. And, you know, with Life of Pi, there's a tiger in the lifeboat, right? And, you know, I imagine it was fun and exciting creating the juxtapositions.
It was. It was amazing. And as the editor, I was seeing everything that came in and everything that was being accepted by the individual editors, but they weren't really aware of what they were doing each other. David Wright was working on nonfiction independently of Philip Graham, who was doing the fiction independently of Mike, who was doing the poetry. And I was watching all of the stuff that they were selecting come in. and I was seeing these connections build, and it was very hard for me not to push those and ask them to do more of that. I liked that it was happening on its own, and that it seemed to validate my initial thoughts about this project, which is that there's this ongoing conversation in art and literature, that what we wanted to do was basically provide a forum to illuminate that conversation, not to force it, but just to put it out there so people can see the connections that are constantly being made.
Yeah. Well, it's like how a conversation takes place. There's got to be a certain mindfulness, but there's also spontaneity in any conversation. You want to talk with us, Michael, about your thoughts as poetry editor and in helping that happen?
Well, I think that one of the things that we did notice was as submission solicitations were out there, we did notice that there were certain thematic elements that were operating in this conversation at a given time, which I think was incredibly comforting in a way, and suggested that this was going to be successful as we were moving ahead. I think one of the things that we were talking about before in relation to the chaos, there is a beautiful thing about having the staff operate as it does, certainly on the poetry side. There must be 6 or 7 students that are involved actively in reading, and then we sit down and try and decide what's going on. And, of course, everyone's aesthetic gets to be heard. And then some overall force, which may sometimes be mine, is involved in the decision-making. But often people are seeing connections to things that I may not see going on. And I think there's an act of faith, I think, that's involved in an awful lot of this endeavor. And I think that it's rewarded when we just kind of open up to it. Mm. And it seemed like it came together. I think part of what we're doing, this meeting next week, is probably sitting down and responding to that and saying, oh, my gosh, look at what happened. And I think with all the diversity, and this is something that I'm proud of with the poetry, that we have a great range of styles and attempts at moving at the poem, solution to the poem, and that I'm very happy with.
Let's talk with another listener, caller on line 1. Hello.
You doing?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Listening to everything, you know, with the contributors to the magazine, Booker Prize winner, Pulitzer Prize winners, the rare finds of the Mark Twain letters, and I understand that at AWP, the magazine made quite a buzz in Chicago last month. I just wanted to know what the editors thought and how they see their magazine as it's put up against other magazines from other universities.
Well, I think obviously we think that this magazine is doing something entirely different from a number of magazines that are out there right now. Not that there aren't many high quality journals out there publishing essentially the best fiction and nonfiction and poetry that you can find in America today. But what we're trying to do is our mission statement is more defined in a way, because we're not just looking for the best work we can find, but we're trying to take that work and put it together in a way that makes a complete reading experience for an audience. And we're also we're using the design elements and the visual art in a way that no other magazines are doing. We're so fortunate to have the School of Art and Design involved in this project, because there is no other literary magazine that's doing what we're doing in terms of the visual.
Listener, anything to follow up on there?
Yes, especially with the reading the manifesto. So are the editors excited about the possibility of discovering, you know, really great new talent that's coming through in submission processes?
Certainly. That's been a mission of mine for a long time. In my other jobs, I made a definite effort to continue to look for new writers who have not published or who have published very little, that who have a strong and unique voice that I can bring to the public. And I think that Mike feels the same way.
Yes.
For poetry.
And I also think that within the confines of the well-known writer and the well-known poet, I think often that writer, that poet, is doing something that's probably experimental that he or she may be afraid to send out to a particular magazine for some reason or not. And recently in emailing with a particular poet, I asked him for work that was more urgent to what he was doing and not necessarily to something that was expected of him out there. And that's the kind of thing that I'm looking for. And I also know that we've gotten the more eccentric work, I think, often from some very well-known writers. And that's very exciting to me.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. The poetry that opens Ninth Letter, they're new poems. They've never been published before, right?
Not in the United States.
Not in the United States.
This was a wonderful collaboration with a translator who was at Harvard. And this, of course, says something about this university and our ability to reach out to people and be able to get this quality of poems. These poems by Tomas Solomon, I think, are exquisite, and they do show a great deal of range. They had never been published before in the United States, and Peter Richards, the translator, did an exceptional job, I think, with this work. And Solomon was generally a very private person, and I was somewhat afraid to ask him to send us this front piece to his work to hand write a poem. And he, in his email back, I had said I thought we would make it look fairly dramatic, and he said, "Well, please don't make it look overly dramatic." And I think it turned out beautifully. I think the whole presentation and we just got an email from him that congratulated us on this endeavor, and I don't know how many copies I think he ordered. It was
He
bought 10 copies beyond what we were giving him as contributors' copies because he was so pleased to see it. And that, of course, makes us very happy.
Do you want to read that first poem for us that's included here?
Could you read it in the Slovenian?
Yeah, that's also really a really beautiful thing too, is to seeing the poetry in the poet's native language and then seeing across from it the translation.
Yeah, we made a deliberate choice to do that, even though it obviously takes up quite a number of pages in the magazine. But I think that just visually, even though I know that most of our readers won't be able to understand it at all, to see the poem in its original mm-hmm. language with the translation, it makes the experience of reading the poems that much more interesting.
Mm-hmm. The poem is entitled "He" by Tomas Solomon. Turn frescoes around prominently and we'll have plenty of everything. This creaks like a white sail that travels the broad sea. Only sell your piece of meat to your parents and ancestors. They remember it very well. Woods blaze, they nurture. The great one withdraws. He's nowhere. Flowers blissfully nod off if you ask them something. They don't tell. They wake up amiably.
Poetry by Tomas Solomon, forgive me, read by Michael Madonik, the poetry editor for the Ninth Letter. In the interview that is included in the Ninth Letter, Jan Martel, talking with Philip Graham, he speaks of the importance of knowing as a writer where he's going. And he's critical of himself. He says, well, the story lags in the middle. And he makes the same criticism of an earlier novel. strengths and weaknesses? Are you now at a space, and it sounds like this is going to be part of the meeting next week, but are you at a space now where you can see strengths and weaknesses, and what challenges do you see lying ahead for the next issue?
I think the biggest challenge, of course, would be to follow up the first issue, which has turned out in a way that exceeded all of our expectations and has gotten such an amazing reception both in the local community and in the literary community as a whole. One thing that I think that we will constantly strive to do, at least on the you know editorial part, is to find a balance to make sure that we continue to find new original voices. With this first issue being the first issue, we were very happy to get a number of big names, well-known writers and poets that contributed some amazing work. And of course, we want to continue to get amazing work from respected writers, but we want to make a concerted effort to seek out new writers and make sure that that stays a part of our mission. At this point, the biggest task ahead is to get the magazine out there, to get people reading it, to get it known, and to have people sending us their best work.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that that art and design suggested initially, which sounded wonderful to me, was this continuous change of format, and even the symbol ninth letter will change as the magazine progresses. And I think that notion of change, this bundling image of barbed wire that you suggested, I think is a beautiful one. I think often if magazines have trouble, they're striving to repeat themselves. And I think what we're trying to do is assess what we've done and not repeat and try something different. There will be a sense of consistency, I think, about its general shape and form, a general format. But we're going to be trying, I think, each time to invent ourselves or reinvent ourselves. And I think that's you can't bundle up barbed wire the same way every time.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I think that image is so apt.
Yeah. And I also think that, you know, the students continuing to come into the MFA program in creative writing is where some of that new visionary kind of thing is going to come from, right, Chris?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think there's no question that the crop of students that we have now and the new people who came in this year each time are bringing new ideas to the table, a new maybe aesthetic vision, and new ways in which just the way the sort of synapses are firing when we collaborate with each other. So I think every year when a new group comes in, there's going to be some new ideas, and they're going to add to this idea of evolution that Mike was talking about. That I think that also it points to the way in which we go about putting together this magazine, which is different, I think, than a lot of magazines, in the sense that the designers don't start designing the magazine until we have accepted everything. And then they read everything. And so it is a fully conceptual process for them. They read around the work. They read other works that these writers have written. So it's not as easy. We could never do this as writers. We couldn't. A lot of magazines are put together, and they become a sort of template where you can plug stuff in, and the designers maybe become less important. Every single time, this is going to be evolving, and there's no way. We're just in awe of what they're able to do.
That's got to be really exciting, that interchange between writers and artists, you know, to see how someone reacts to something you've written and how they would illustrate it and how they would put it on the page.
I think unanimously the writers in this issue were ecstatic with the way that their work was designed. The fiction writers and the nonfiction writers have more graphic elements on their pages than the poets. The poets thought that the layout that they have was beautiful, but the fiction writers and the nonfiction writers were bowled over completely by the way that the designers read and envisioned their works. And in most cases, they said that they would never have read their stories that way, that they would never have thought to illustrate them in that way, but the selections that the designers made were so apt that they brought out elements in the story that may have been overlooked but made the stories that much richer to read. So, I can't say enough about how wonderful it is to have this kind of collaboration, and it makes it exciting for us. Once the selection process is over, we get to then continue this creative process. We don't just select the work and then put it together and it's done. There's a whole other level of creation that comes in with the design.
Mm-hmm. What happens, Chris, you know, when you have somebody illustrate a piece of work, what happens between that collaboration, if you would, in terms of, even if maybe you don't have direct contact with the artist, but do you see things, as Jody was saying, that you really maybe hadn't paid so much attention to in the piece, but yet the artist picks up on it? And I wonder if then that, when you go back, could it inspire you to write something as a result of how a piece is illustrated?
I guess it could. The question would be, is so few places are doing it that I don't know if you really write something with the visuals in mind, and that could be maybe something that we're sort of pushing forward here, a new avenue. But I really, even magazines, there are a few literary magazines out there who will put pictures beside things, and I think some of them are very visually beautiful to look at. But when I've gone through, it's not always clear to me why the images were selected. So I think it's wonderful to think about those things coming together, but I also think that in the sort of climate of where literature is right now, you don't necessarily think about what's someone going to put beside my work or how would that operate. I think one of the things that's very interesting about what the design people are doing is a lot of them are, as Joseph said in his afterword, narrative media artists. And so they're very interested in this collaboration of the visual and the written and the electronic. And it just seems to be sort of spurring us in the direction of maybe some new things are going to happen in literature and the arts in general.
Yeah. But now in poetry, Tomas Salomon said, you know, don't make that too dramatic. So, you know, there's a boundary there, but it's being pushed, I guess, huh?
I think it's always going to be pushed. And what I'd like to say, the design people have, it's not only what they've done, it's what they've chosen not to do. And I think that they've exercised restraint in areas where I think restraint should be placed. I think for me, one of the more exciting pieces in here visually is Marjorie Sandor's piece in the creative nonfiction area, which looks spectacular. On the poetry side, though, I think poets are fairly actively engaged in a sense of field composition anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think that the design people are being respectful of that. So because we have such a large format, I mean, this 9x12 format, I think there are many poets that would love to see their work in a format this size. I mean, this kind of canvas not only appeals to the design people, but appeals to the writer. And the placement on that canvas becomes interesting. So on the poetry side, we have Joy Manitsiotis, whose work moves almost from margin to margin. And then we also have very contained prose poems pieces. So I think we're also exploring this space. And it's an interesting exercise, I think, for all of us.
Did the impact of the graphic art dictate the format, dictate the size of the journal?
Yes, it did. Nan Goggin and Jennifer Gungey-Balzrud are our designers, and I realize we've been referring to them as the design people, which isn't fair because they deserve to be recognized by name. Nan and Jen, we went back and forth with trim size options for a while. We had initially wanted to do something slightly larger than standard journal format. But after they had met with printers, they determined that actually the most cost-effective move, if we went further than standard journal size, would be to go to a full 9x12. That's just in terms of, you know, using paper and how much paper you have to cut. And they were actually very excited by this for obvious reasons, because if we were willing to go with an oversized format, they would have a lot more room to be creative with the design. And I think that we were just a little bit nervous at first, because if you put this on a bookstore shelf next to all the other literary journals in the journal section, this doesn't look like it. It almost looks like it doesn't belong there. It looks like it belongs with the art magazines, which it probably belongs with the art magazines as well. But once we kind of got past that initial nervousness, we realized what a stunning effect this was going to have on readers and buyers. So we went for it, and I think everybody was happy with the way it turned out.
Mm. We've talked a couple of times. We've mentioned, we really haven't talked about this, but the word has been mentioned. Michael, you mentioned it, and one of our callers mentioned it, manifesto. What's in the manifesto?
A part of the manifesto is actually reproduced in my introduction to the magazine. The manifesto was written by Chris fairly early on in the development of this project, and was initially, I think, intended to be kind of an internal office document to keep everybody on the same page as to what the mission of the magazine was. But I found it was so inspiring to me. It was actually one of the reasons why, after I had my interview for this job, I went home with fingers crossed, hoping I would get the job, because I couldn't believe that these people were so in tune with what I wanted, what I thought needed to be done, what I wanted to do in literary publishing. I don't know if Chris wants to read part of it.
I can read part of it. It's down in the gutter a little bit. So
yeah.
All right.
Don't you have it memorized?
Yeah, I should. I should have it memorized. I'll just go for it. It says, Ninth Letter is a publication that rejects the notion that literature is an isolated mode of expression. Instead, we recognize and seek the intersections of literature with various fields of creative and intellectual life, such as visual arts, journalistic arts, science, history, and cultural studies. We seek these intersections not only in the creative content we accept, but also in the overall design and form of the magazine itself. In this sense, we view the magazine as an organic work of art. The overall interaction among components is as important as the discrete sections within the content. This approach necessarily forces us within our pages to ask and answer the question why. In other words, we intend to undercut the recent tradition of so-called clever publications by raising the aesthetic choices of the magazine within the content of the magazine itself. As a result, the dialogue will serve a central role, acting as a bridge between the disparate aspects of the magazine. Therefore, each issue will not be a mere container for discrete, isolated objects. Rather, it will, on all levels, from content to graphic design, generate a full and cohesive conversation.
Hmm. And before we have to wrap up, tell us about the internet site, the website. This has gone now beyond a journal that can sit in your lap.
Again, yeah, we're breaking as many borders as we possibly can, this is some of what Joseph Squire was talking about in his afterword. The electronic site, in addition to any information you need to know about the print magazine, you can also find original electronic multimedia work. Right now, I think they have there's a video interview with one of the artists featured in this magazine, Reagan Louie. You can hear the audio interview with Jan Martel, and they've got some other projects underway that are going to be up by the summer. So the web is another medium in which we can continue the conversation. So we're going to make use of that as much as possible.
Yeah, very good. And that is ninthletter.com. And ninth is spelled out, NINTH, ninthletter.com. We've used up the time. It went so quickly. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And keep the chaos going, huh? Our guests this afternoon have been Jody Rubens and Michael Madonic and Chris Meyer. They are editors of the new literary journal at the University of Illinois, Ninth Letter. Copies of the journal are available at the Illini Union Bookstore and Borders Books Music and Cafe. They will also be available at a party launching the journal this evening at 7 p.m. at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois. And three writers whose work appears in the first issue will perform readings this evening at that party. That's at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall, 7 o'clock this evening. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, and we should have settlement prices now from the Chicago Board of Trade.
And with those numbers, I'm Tom Rogers, and it was an up day after a pretty steep drop on the Board of Trade yesterday. Technical bounce in most of the markets, and the markets ended up on an up note to end the week. May wheat ended today at 388.5. The high today, 390. The low, 383.5. Settled at 388.5. Up 5.5 cents on the day. July wheat had a high of 399.5, 392.5 the low, settlement at 397.25, up 5.25. September wheat, the high 404, the low 398, settled at 402.5, up 6. December, the high 413, the low 406, settlement at 411.75, up 5 cents on the day. And the March wheat for next year, the high 416, the low 411, settled at the high 416, up 5.5 cents. In the corn pit, May had a high today of 315.5, the low 308, settled at 314.5, up 7. July had a high of 322.5, the low 315.5, settlement 321, up 4.75. September corn, the high 318, the low 311, settled at 314, up 5.5. December, 314.5, the high, 305, the low, settlement at 311, ending the week there, up 6.5 cents on the day. March corn for next year, the high 317, the low 311, settled 314.25, up 6.75. May of next year's corn had a high of 318, the low 314.5, settled at 316, up 6.5. July farside corn, the high 318, the low 314, settled at 316, right in the middle, the high or up 6.5 cents. And December of 05 corn, the high 280, the low 276.5, settled at 278.75, just off the high, up 3.25 cents. May oats had a high today of $1.63, the low 158, settled at 162, up 3.25. July had a high of 168.75, the low 163.75, settlement at 167.25, up 2. Now we go to the soybeans, where they had an up day, a technical bounce. The May bean contract had a high today of 977.75, the low 953, settlement at 965, up 2. July had a high of 977, the low 953, 966 the settlement, up 1.5. The nearby contracts, the old crop contracts, not gaining quite as much as the new crop today. August soybeans had a high of 922, the low $9 even, settled at 910, up 6.5. September soybeans, the high $8 even, the low 780, the settlement at 788.5, up 14 cents on the day. November beans, the high 734, the low 720, settled at 732.5, up 15.5. January of next year's beans, 735 the high, 721 the low, settled at 732.5, up 18 cents. And March beans, 727 the high, the low 716, settled at 725, up 15 cents. In the products, May soybean meal, the high today 308.50, the low 302 even, settled at 304.90, up 150 on the day. July meal, the high 307, the low 350, and the settlement at 302.70. That's up a half, or up 40 on the day, rather. May soybean oil had a high of 32.42, the low 31.55, settled at 32.27, up 56. And July, the high 32.25, the low 31.38, settled at 32.13, up 68. Rather mixed day on the Mercantile Exchange. Here with those numbers, Celeste Quinn.
Thanks, Tom. April, feeder cattle, 92.95, the high 92.45, the low 92.95, the settlement at up 50. May, 89.45, the high 88.50, the low 89.22.5, the settlement at unchanged. August feeder cattle, 91 even, the high 89.50, the low 90.22.5, the settlement at down 52.5. April live cattle, 83 even, the high 81.05, the low 81.80, the settlement at down 87.5. June 77.30, the high, 75.10, the low, 76.07.5, the settlement, that down 87.5. August live cattle, 77.50, the high, 76.20, the low, finishing at 77.15, down 10. October, 78.97.5, the high, 78 even, the low, 78.70, the settlement, that up 2.5. April lean hog, 64.70, the high, 64.20, the low, 64.27.5, the settlement, that down 30. May, 68.65, the high, 67.50, the low, 68.42.5, the settlement, that up 12.5. June lean hogs, 73.10, the high, 70.80, the low, and the settlement, that down to him at 200, down the limit. July lean hogs, 72.10, the high, 70.10, the low, and the settlement, that down the limit, down 200 points. May pork bellies, 102.95, the high, 160, the low, the settlement, 102.45, that up 95. And let's check now on the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. The Dow up 40 points at 10,437. The NASDAQ is down 3 at 1,999. The S&P 500 up 5 at 1,134.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of chocolate, 40 kinds of coffee, and 200 kinds of tea. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Greg Forquer from Lancaster, Ohio writes, Dear Dr. Science, previously you addressed the question of dust bunnies and their propagation by stating that they are the result of mating between the carpet and the hardwood floors. I have hardwood floors, no carpeting, and I still have dust bunnies. What gives?
Do you leave your shoes lying around after you've gone to bed? Unless you stuff them with shoe trees or carefully wrap them in plastic at least 8 millimeters thick, you run the risk of providing nests for onanistic dust bunnies, the kind that can mate with themselves. Sure, statistically they're a minority, but all it takes is a few to start breeding, and pretty soon it's time to buy a dust mop and some new shoes. On the other hand, if for some reason you were interested in raising dust bunnies for fun or profit, then a shoe farm would be an excellent way to go about it. Teach them to do tricks. They lie around the house just like cats, and although they exhibit little personality, they make excellent listeners.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath. To order the Dr. Science Smug Mug, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock.